Shift is brought to you by Planet M. John Riminelli, founder and CEO at Aerospace Experience Technologies, says in Michigan, revolution is in the air. Find out what Planet M is doing to help businesses make that possible at planetm.com. That's planetm.com.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Shift, a podcast about mobility. I'm Pete Bigelow, reporter from the Automotive News and your host. Joining me in the studio today is Leslie Allen, the Shift Mobility Editor. Hi, Leslie. How are you today?
I'm doing fine, Pete. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. I'm excited about today's episode in which we have a conversation with Marcy Cleavorn from Ford. She's currently Ford's Chief Transformation Officer, formerly the president of their Ford Smart Mobility LLC. And she's retiring in a matter of weeks. So excited to talk to her about her perspective on where Ford has been as an auto company and where it's going as a mobility company.
Yeah, that's Ford is probably a pioneer out there in terms of transformation from, you know, strictly working on automotive to working on mobility. I know that was something that started under Bill Ford, the executive chairman.
Yeah, that really was. He, you could probably credit him for being the most prescient of the, automakers or leading the automakers. It was probably close to two decades ago at this point where he laid out a vision that auto companies were no longer just auto companies, but that there was a much bigger market to serve when you viewed transportation mobility as the customer, not necessarily the automotive customer.
And this is an initiative that's been carried out, of course, by Ford former CEO Mark Fields and the current CEO Jim Hackett. And we know that Ford has had to scale back a bit, however, on some of these efforts. You know, these companies do have to make money after all. And I know that, for example, the shuttle service, Chariot, you know, Ford is no longer doing that. And they've also made some other recent changes.
That's right. Within the last few weeks, they sold their Canvas car share to Fair, another company. So you do see collectively two examples of mobility companies facing headwinds here in 2019.
And of course, Ford is still continuing some of its efforts. I mean, one of the biggest examples literally is that they are taking this massive train station, this abandoned train station in Detroit's Corktown neighborhood. It's called the Michigan Central Station. And they're going to be turning it into the focal point of a campus focused on mobility. So that will be interesting to see how that comes out.
That's right. So we're going to talk to Marcy here in a few short minutes about her role and all the changes she's seen during her 30-plus year career with Ford. But first, we have some news of our own here at Shift to share. Leslie, do you want to do the honors?
I do want to do the honors, and our mobility team has expanded. I'm pleased to introduce our newest mobility reporter, Alexa St. John. So, Alexa, welcome to the podcast and to welcome back, I should say, to Automotive News.
Thank you, Leslie. I'm glad to be here.
Now, Alexa is her claim to fame is that she is the former editor-in-chief of the Michigan Daily, which is a well-renowned student publication at the University of Michigan. Alexa has also done internships at Automotive News and most recently at the Wall Street Journal. So, you know, she comes with some serious chops, folks.
Well, I'm excited that you're here too, Alexa. Welcome to the team and look forward to working with you going forward. For now, we're going to take a short break and we'll be right back with our conversation with Marcy Cleavorn.
John Riminelli, founder and CEO at Aerospace Experience Technologies, landed his company in Michigan. He told us it was because he believes in Michigan, revolution is in the air. Planet M agrees. They're working hard to support and grow the state's mobility ecosystem with powerful matchmaking and entrepreneurial resources. The next big thing in mobility is happening in Michigan. Find out what Planet M can offer your business at planetm.com. That's planetm.com.
Marcy, welcome to the podcast, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Pete.
Why don't we go ahead and start with the big news of the day? You have some news to share.
Yes. So after 36 years at Ford and a few years before that at AT&T, I am going to be retiring effective October 1st. So it's an exciting time, a little bittersweet because the people here are amazing and it's been just a privilege of a journey. But it's time.
What made the time right for you now?
I guess a couple things. It's something I've been thinking about for a while, and actually, truth be told, I've attempted one or two or maybe even three times previous, and as Jim Hackett will tell the story. But a couple things. Number one, my mom is getting on in years. She's 82, and I would like to be able to spend some quality time with her while she's still getting out and about. I also made a promise to myself, it might sound silly, that I kind of had a line in the sand for when I turned 60, and I will make that promise, make that commitment to myself by just a few weeks. So I will still be 59 officially, which is good. And also, you know, I've heard a lot of people say this, you just kind of know when it's time. I mean, we only have one life. And I've said this before, these jobs are so all-encompassing, and it's such a privilege. You just get so wholly into it. And I liken it to looking at the world through a paper towel tube, because my focus really had to be automotive and technology. There's not room for a lot of other learnings, curiosities, experiences. And I want to put that tube down and just experience and learn about some other things and give back to a lot of people who have given to me so I could do what I did for so many years.
Automotive and technology, I can't imagine you've been busy the past few years or anything like
that.
No,
it's been really boring, yeah.
Marcy, you mentioned that you're a fourth generation employee of Ford.
That's right.
What's the family lineage there?
My great-grandfather came for the $5 workday. Actually, my great-grandmother had died in childbirth, and he had several children to take care of. So he moved from a farm more towards the northern area of Michigan down here to take care of, to leverage the $5 workday. And then my grandfather worked here as well. He worked in purchasing for a while, transmission, for many years. I think he had 43 years with the company. And then my uncle worked here, and now myself. And I will have to also add that my nephew on my husband's side works here now. He just came over from FCA to work on our autonomous vehicle program. We're all in.
Did you grow up in Michigan then?
I did, yeah. I grew up in Michigan in the Detroit area, went to University of Michigan, so very very local. I did work in Europe for a while. I was the CIO of Ford Europe for a while, and that was a great experience. So I'm living in Germany and working with the team there, but for the most part have lived here.
Okay. So your current title is Chief Transformation Officer.
That's correct.
And before that, you were president of Ford Smart Mobility, mm-hmm. and you've held a variety of jobs and titles over your three decades with Ford. Mm-hmm. So why don't we go ahead and just start from the beginning.
Sure.
Take me back to 1983. You were working at AT&T. What made you interested in jumping to the auto industry?
Well, at first I wasn't, to be honest. I was working at AT&T. I really liked my job. I started in marketing there on the Ford account, but I quickly discovered that more than that, I liked solving business problems with technology. So I moved to a more technical role there, but still working with Ford. And Ford offered me a job actually three different occasions, and I turned them down because I really liked what I was doing. And then what happened in 1983, so this is going to really date me, but the U.S. government broke up AT&T as a monopoly. And so what we were working on shrunk in complexity because they had to break it up into different companies to avoid being a monopoly. And I could see my job getting boring. So Ford came back around that time, offered me another job. I took it, thought I'd hang out for a couple years till I really figured out what I wanted to do. And of course, it was such a great experience. Here I still am 36 years later. Ford is so rich in complexity and a global reach, and there's so many functions that make up putting a great, safe automobile on the road, not to mention all the other services and businesses we're getting into, that every time I moved, it was almost like starting with a new company, but with the benefit of the network I had created.
When you started 1983, IT wasn't necessarily viewed as a space that was friendly for women, and the auto industry was not necessarily viewed as a space that's friendly for women. Mm-hmm. What was it like making the jump at that time? In that context.
And so it's interesting you bring that up, because actually that's one of the reasons I did not make the jump initially, was because when I looked around, There were not a lot of females here, or just probably none, to be pretty much none. And that AT&T, they had done a lot of recent hiring, and it was a much more diverse atmosphere. But they really, you know, worked hard to get me to come. And after I came, I saw that I could make a difference. IT was totally different back then, as you have alluded to. But it's been really a lot of fun seeing IT grow in importance, see that really every company now is a technology company in some way, and just how the importance has shifted from really being a backroom function to mechanizing business processes to really being the top line, not just the bottom line.
Do you think the auto industry has gotten friendlier for women since? I mean, obviously, we're talking a long timeline, but at the same time, 2019 doesn't necessarily feel like, you know, equality is all it should be at this point, too.
I think that's a fair statement. I think we still have a ways to go. And I think one of the things I've tried to work on with some various organizations that I support is starting with young girls and getting them feeling confident about what they can do and not self-selecting out of some of the STEM efforts, not, you know, taking different kinds of classes in school. One organization I belong to, Michigan Council of Women in Technology, going to the schools, helping the girls with web design, with robotics, things like that, so they can grow in confidence. And what I tell them is, no matter what you want to get into, because some will say, well, I really want to do fashion. Fashion is a technology business, too. I mean, Burberry really set the world on fire with virtual fitting rooms, and things like that have evolved. So I think just giving girls confidence that they can do it, and it's no matter where they turn, it will open doors in really any industry they want to be a part of. Automotive is a little tougher, and I think just traditionally it's been that way, but obviously we're working hard to make a very diverse workplace here in all senses of the word, and you know, we'll continue the journey.
Broadly speaking, how does the mobility industry compare to the automotive industry in that respect?
The mobility industry is largely founded in technology, so I think its roots are a lot in some of the tech companies. So probably still a challenge from a diversity perspective. I know all of us read about some of the challenges some of the Silicon Valley companies have with diversity. So I think it's, you know, obviously different than the automotive industry, but I think it still has some of the challenges as well.
You alluded to the fact that every company now is a technology company. When did you feel that transition during your time here at Ford?
That's a really great question. I mentioned that the evolution for me, it's just simply put, was from backroom to recognizing that technology could be used to mechanize and redesign business processes to being really a frontline or top-line benefit. So for me, it was kind of around that transition of not just mechanizing business processes and redesigning business through technology, but knowing that technology can help contribute to the top line. And I would say it was probably a little bit middle of my career in IT when I think the light bulb started to go on for all of us that it could be a real differentiator. It could not only help you be efficient, but it could improve your product. It could create a better experience for people. It could attract better people, more a diverse workforce to your workplace by using technology and making the workplace feel like that. If you're going to create those experiences for your customers, you, of course, have to have them here in the workplace to inspire people and to make sure that they feel confident and comfortable, too.
All right. Maybe along similar lines, a transition from not just a technology company, but automotive has gone from automotive to a mobility company. And Bill Ford was probably the first person in the industry to really, you know, hammer that home. When did that light bulb go off for you? Was there an aha moment where you really kind of saw what was developing, you know, a ways back?
So I think an aha moment for many of us, and you alluded to it, was Bill. In 2011, he did a TED Talk, and he talked about a lot of things that, frankly, people kind of laughed at or scoffed at the time. He talked about the fact that urbanization was coming and we hadn't even really begun to see the impacts of it. He talked about congestion. He talked about air quality. He talked about changing consumer attitudes. And, you know, who knew that, you know, even 5 years ago, you'd get an anxiety attack if you couldn't locate your smartphone because everything you do is on it. And people have come to expect the speed and the agility of everything they interact with to be just like that. And then you think about a product like a vehicle that takes really about 7 years from, you know, conception to job one. And how do you get it to meet those consumer expectations? And what I really love about Bill and Ford is that we uniquely, somewhat, I think, feel a responsibility towards helping with things like air congestion, air quality and congestion. Henry Ford, we really helped put the world on wheels when he modernized the assembly line, which brought the cost of vehicles down, which made them accessible to even the people that worked on the line. So that put more vehicles on the road. I know he never thought about the fact that could cause some of these other issues, but that happened too. And so we feel responsible through some of the other businesses that we can participate in, and also some of the things we do with our vehicles to make them more green, to participate in all kinds of different ways in solving those problems.
Yeah, I thought that was the really interesting thing about what Bill said during his TED Talk in 2011 was not just a automotive company thinking as a mobility company, but it was the idea that an automotive company would think about the consequences or byproducts of putting so many vehicles on the road. And I think that was kind of a real pivot for the industry at that point, too.
Truly was. And, you know, even when I took on the mobility job, people questioning, well, some of the things you do might mean that we sell less vehicles. And maybe that would be true as we get into sharing, or as cities start to legislate how many vehicles can be in the city. That's already happening, as we know, or they control it through license plate numbers. But if you don't choose to participate differently, you might not be participating at all. And so many businesses, there's some great examples out there of businesses that kind of had to eat their own lunch in order to reinvent themselves and really take their business to the next level.
Do you think, where is the auto industry at in that respect, in terms of eating its own lunch to kind of look at the potentially, you know, much more lucrative future?
I think there's, in some ways, focused very hard on it, but in other ways, because of the products we're talking about, it might take a while. Everything happens in cities, and cities are all around the world. And no city, I learned a lot about this in the mobility group through our city solutions team, no city is the same. And so some cities are going to take very aggressive stances, and some are not, for whatever reasons that they choose. And so we have to be able to interact with all the cities on all different levels. And so I think for that reason, some things will take some time, but we have to act now and be ready, because it is starting now.
I wanted to ask you about that aspect of cities are so different. And I think Ford is unique in the respect that it is set up operations in Miami and Washington, mm-hmm. D.C., and it has this micro mobility grant program that it's initiated, and you have projects in Austin, Texas, and I think some of the automotive competitors or even tech competitors have kind of focused on a single city.
Right.
So is this idea that cities are so different that you kind of want to get out and learn from as many different ones as possible, is that why Ford has kind of had this broader focus?
It's a great question. I think that's part of it. The more cities you interact with, you learn more about how to improve your product, different services you can offer them, and then how you work with them in partnership, getting back to some of Bill's TED Talk topics that we just referenced. But there's another aspect to it, too. When the world of autonomy comes upon us, and it's already, you know, here and in evolving, that will happen in cities, too. And so you can't just show up at some point and say, hey, we've got these autonomous vehicles, we want to participate. Building those relationships and learning how you become part of the fabric of the city and not just a bolt-on that's an annoyance is something that's very important to us. And that's one of the big reasons that we're fostering these relationships with many cities.
Is that kind of, you know, that idea of working with cities early, did that codify? And is that why Ford kind of broke out Ford Smart Mobility LLC in 2016?
It wasn't only because of the cities that we decided to break it out as an LLC. It was a recognition that that business group would have to maybe operate differently than a 115-year-old automotive company. and so to allow the freedom for that to happen.
So that was 2016 that Ford first established the Ford Smart Mobility. We're only 3 years down the road from that, but I feel like the whole mobility space has changed so dramatically in that time.
Unbelievable.
Would you share that kind of general sentiment?
Oh, huge. And I think it's just going to continue to change faster and faster and faster. So as soon as you think, oh, here's a trend and should we jump on it, it will have passed you by, or it might fizzle out. So I think one thing that's uncomfortable for a company like Ford is that you're going to make mistakes. And you have to get comfortable with the fact that we're going to try some things, and some things are going to work and some things aren't going to work. And I think tech companies are used to that. They launch something, it's just software, we can pull it back. And we're just not used to that. We make a product that, you know, we take very seriously from safety and a risk perspective. And it's a different world to operate in this quickly moving atmosphere that you're describing, Pete, that is a lot of it rooted in software, which can be developed very fast, changed, thrown out. So it is a little bit of how do these two worlds come together that are moving at such different speeds. But we need them to come together to create a great experience for our customers.
How have you seen Detroit and Silicon Valley, to put it in those really general terms, come together or not? What work still remains and what's happened so far?
So we have a group in Palo Alto, actually a large office there, Greenfield Labs. And so I've had teams down there for quite some time and have spent a lot of time down there. And I think that the worlds are starting to come together as, back to our discussion about how every business is a technology business, the automotive industry has always been rich in technology. The vehicle obviously is a very technical product. But as more and more software is introduced into it, and also as the experience that the vehicle provides becomes more important than maybe just the vehicle itself, I think that is bringing these two worlds together. And so, you know, we are hiring employees locally there from Stanford and other places, and we're attracting them because I think the automotive industry is very attractive now, very interesting. It's obviously, you know, being disrupted in a huge amount of ways. And I think people are also interested in being part of something that might change the world. And so I think that in that way, the two worlds are kind of coming together.
Talking about AVs in general, when are we going to see widespread deployment? When do you envision like all these things that we talk about actually making a significant impact on city streets?
Well, if I had a crystal ball, I'd probably be able to tell you and then it'd be rich. But so I think nobody really knows. We are launching our own vehicle at the end of 2021, and we believe that the first uses will be commercial use, moving people, moving goods, those kinds of businesses. And we don't think it'll be widespread for personal use for quite a number of years. And there's other issues just besides technology. We talked about how cities operate independently oftentimes, and they may have their own legislation. You have to go in and you have to be able to map the cities. So there's a lot that will go into getting them to be widespread, aside from just getting the technology ready.
Speaking of cities, you know, I notice a lot lately that ridership numbers for public transit are really down. And on the other hand, we have autonomous vehicles kind of around the corner, at least in a public context. What is the role of autonomy for mass transportation or public transportation if those two things are the same thing? And I'm not so sure they are.
I think, and I'll answer the question, but correct me if I'm not answering the question that you asked. I think the role of autonomy could be that it provides options for A, ride sharing, or B, ways to better leverage the existing public transportation network by helping people get from wherever their location is to a hub that provides, you know, the more mass transportation. Cities are suffering through lack of use of that, and you know, it takes a lot of investment, obviously, from the cities to keep that running. So it'll be very interesting to see how they balance all this with the things like scooters on the micro side of things evolving. You have autonomy evolving. You have maybe other different forms of micro mobility transportation that will evolve. You have people riding more bicycles than they ever have, and the bike paths becoming more and more important. You have the regular vehicles, you have mass transit, so all this kind of transportation coming together. Well, it'll have to be made sense of in some way. And like I said, it's all going to happen in the cities, so they have a lot to think about.
Well, you mentioned scooters, and earlier you talked about trends that kind of come out of nowhere that you know that we kind of try and grasp onto. What is the future of scooters? And I know, you know, that's probably something you didn't foresee in 2016 and in more recent years. Was it last year that Ford bought Spin?
Mm-hmm.
So what is the role of scooters? And was that one of those trends that kind of came out of nowhere?
I think a lot of people feel like it seemingly did come out of nowhere. I remember early on with Bird and Lime, it was all, you know, the growth was just exponential. And if you look at the growth of scooter rides compared even to Uber and Lyft. They hit 10 million rides a lot faster than even Uber and Lyft did with that form of transportation. I think what's great and why it's growing so fast, number one, it's accessible. So by accessible, I mean really in two different lenses. Number one, it's, you know, readily available. You don't have to hail it. You know, you can just find one. And then B, the cost is so low. It is accessible from that perspective, too. It's a low-cost form of transportation. And the other thing is in areas of congestion. My son and daughter happen to live in New York. I spend a fair amount of time there. And sometimes you're in a vehicle because the average speed of Manhattan is what I think is like 8 miles an hour. You can see where you want to go. You can think, I could even just walk there faster. So not only does a transportation like scooters provide a good like last mile to maybe to get to another form of transportation, in going short distance when things are congested, it also provides probably a faster way than any other form of transportation. So I think that's why it's really taken off, you know, plus they're fun.
I saw someone on a scooter the other day on a kind of arterial road that had a bike lane, but on the flip side, there's cars going by at 55, 60 miles an hour. And I was curious, do you think that there's an infrastructure in place that supports micromobility like scooters?
You know, it's a really good question. Jim Hackett has dinner guests for us once a month, and he invited Riley Brennan to come and talk. And I actually asked him, like, is there something, this is about a year ago, maybe even more, that we're not thinking about? And he brought up the bike lanes. And he said, you know, his kind of thinking, and it happened so fast now it's here, but this is a little over a year ago, his thinking was that the bike lanes are going to be like the next hot spot for usage. And a lot of cities don't have them, or they have them, but they're not really protected. Or people use the sidewalks, and that, you know, causes a problem for people trying to walk, for pedestrians. So I think many cities aren't prepared for this resurgence that will be that mean that the bike lane gets used a lot more, and what are the safety issues around that, not only for cyclists but for scooters and other possible forms of transportation. You know, the scooter themselves are going to continue to evolve, and they already have, becoming more robust, adding different features. And then I guess the question is, does that form factor continue to evolve? Maybe there's a three-wheel form factor. So I think we will see that form factor continue to grow and evolve.
Package delivery seems to be this aspect of mobility that has really caught fire more recently. What is the role for Ford in terms of rolling that out?
Well, we are looking at different business uses for the autonomous vehicles, and that obviously is a big one. Amazon is just a living example, but there's so many other companies now realizing that to compete, convenience is king for consumers, and a lot of people don't have time to go to the physical store. So, you know, really almost every big chain you can think of provides some kind of delivery service. And then you see, you know, companies like Amazon providing their own, trying to edge out FedEx, and there's a whole, you know, little brouhaha going on about that right now. And so we do see a role for Ford there. We're still working through some of the business cases ideas, but we definitely see a role for both moving goods and moving people. And our vehicle that we're launching is purpose-built, so it will be able to accommodate both those things.
What's the role for electric vehicles and all that? Obviously, a lot of automakers have made billion-dollar investments in EVs, and when are they coming?
Well, EVs are, I mean, here right now, right? So
I'll amend that. When are they coming in widespread use?
I think actually in the next, you know, couple years probably, because of going back to the city. So some cities are already starting to legislate no ICE internal combustion engines in the city. And what that means is that if you want to participate, you've got to come up with a battery electric option. Also, as the cost will continue to drive down over time, that will make it more accessible, more affordable for people, many more people than have it today. I know there's range anxiety. Are there enough charging stations? So those are some infrastructure problems that will have to be solved before it's probably really, really widespread. But already certain cities are, you know, taking the air quality issue very seriously and jumping on that.
So I feel like we've hit all the major mobility buckets, except maybe do you see a role for air transportation in mobility, whether it's like personally owned taxis or drones that carry deliveries or cargo? How far away is something like that, if you think it's a factor at all?
Oh, I think it is a factor. I mean, we already are seeing, you know, widespread use of drones. VTOLs, the vertical takeoff and landing units at CES, there was a big display of those this January 2019. We're looking into certain ideas there, too. So I think it definitely does have a role in highly congested areas. Obviously, affordability will be a problem for some people. But as anything, once it becomes more mainstream, some of the cost does tend to come down. You know, there's all kinds of other legislative issues with airspace and with landing in cities and all that to be worked through. But I definitely see there'll be a role there. Okay. Absolutely.
Tell us more about your current role as the Chief Transformation Officer. What are you working on, and what are the issues that you see?
So when I announced my retirement, Jim asked, well, you know, stick around a little bit longer and help accelerate some things within the company that he had been focused on and would like to kind of see go a little faster. So that's what we've been doing. Some examples are agile teams. So when I was the CIO in IT, and then also when I had the mobility team, we organized ourselves like a software company does in true product teams. And by that, I mean there's a product owner who knows the business model, who knows the customer, what the business is they're going to create. There's a product manager who's the technical lead that, you know, helps create the product. And then there's team members that are, you know, whether they're analytics specialists or software engineers or whatever, depending on what the product is that make up the team. And so Jim and we were able to do a lot of great things with that construct. The teams are very small. Jeff Bezos calls them two pizza teams, the 10 to 12 people teams. And Jim, one of the things he asked me to do was think about how we could make that more widespread within the company. And so we've been working with some of the teams outside of the areas I talked about on that. Working on some aspects of diversity. He asked me to look into that. So we've actually been conducting some experiments and trying to take a little bit of a scientific approach to that. He has me thinking about, in fact, I'm smiling because we have a meeting with him later today on this, thinking about if AI were ubiquitous throughout the company, like how that would feel. So we actually developed a prototype that we're going to show him today that was a little Jetson-like about, you know, if you were working in a company that was totally immersed in this, like what are some of the things that are possible? So we're going to show him some thoughts on that today.
What are some examples of that?
Well, things like if you're in a meeting and you make a face because something's being discussed or decisions being made and you don't agree with it, it can pick up the expression, stop the meeting, and say, oh, did you have something else to share, or do you have a problem with that? So, or information being available before you even know, just by cue words in the conversation, that, you know, the information, oh, if it hears this word, it knows that this data might be appropriate. Queuing up an outside expert, just, you know, magically knowing that a certain topic is being approached where an external perspective might be helpful. So those are some of the things that we're kind of playing around with in our prototype. Actually, the first thing he had me do was look at revamping the corporate governance. So in June, we launched a revamped corporate governance process to help with the speed of decision making, be a little more agile, reduce our, you know, some of the bureaucracy involved. So that was a lot of fun too. So
it seems like you have too many big projects going on to you know, retire October 1st here.
Well, we're in wrap-up mode for most of them. Some of the things have been launched, but also what I was careful to do is find a partner to turn everything over with. So when I started anything, I always identified who my partner was going to be. So you got to have an exit strategy too, right?
To bring some of this full circle, you started in IT, and you know, in a lot of ways, a back-end cloud right now is kind of one of the more unheralded yet very important aspects of mobility and in making making transportation seamless for cities and for, you know, operators as well. What sort of things are you working on as far as establishing a cloud for data that's either coming off vehicles or coming from cities, and what role does that play?
So we first invested and acquired a company called Autonomic a year and a half or so back. And what we are working on with them, what we've already launched, is what we call the Transportation Mobility Cloud. And it is a platform that actually runs on a cloud. And what it does, it's a place where I almost think of it as the glue. where data can be gathered from our vehicles, data maybe from cities. We have launched partnerships, Amazon Smart Delivery to Trunk. We've launched partnerships with car washes, et cetera. And it can all come together in the Transportation Mobility Cloud so people can exchange information and get access to information through the use of APIs.
Also bring this full circle. You know, if you were talking to a fellow Ross School of Business graduate from University of Michigan who's walking out the doors of college today, what advice would you have for them as far as working in the auto industry or mobility industry?
I mean, my advice would be to try it, because if you can manage your way, automotive industry is one of the most complicated industries with its many tiers of suppliers, a very complicated product, a product that plays an important part in people's lives, whether you own one, rent one, ride in one. It allows people access to healthcare, jobs, social outlets. So, you know, mobility or the freedom to move is such a fundamental part of people's lives. It's so important. And it's changing so much. So it's really a great time to join the automotive industry. And if you can weave your way through the complexity, you can survive and do anything. So that's my advice.
Okay. Any bold predictions about the future of mobility before you head off?
I haven't given that a lot of thought. I guess the prediction I would have is that, you know, I think there's some questions out there. So you got the automotive players, and then you have the big tech company players. And, you know, and I probably am a little biased perhaps, but my money's on the automotive players, because I think we can uniquely provide a vertically integrated experience, because the vehicle is the really complicated part. And I think there's others out there finding out that, you know, making a vehicle that's meets all the legislative requirements, that's safe, that is comfortable, that provides a great experience, isn't such an easy thing to do in mass. So I do think that, we're quickly learning maybe some of the tech company stuff and incorporating that. So I guess my prediction would be don't count out the automotives.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today, Marcy. We appreciate it.
Oh, thank you for your interest in Ford, and it was great talking with you, Pete. Thank you.
Yeah, likewise. Best wishes in retirement.
Pete, great conversation with Marcy Clevorin, who, by the way, has twice been named to Automotive News' list of 100 leading women. She made the list in 2010 and 2015.
That's very interesting. I didn't know that. But good trivia there to perhaps end our podcast. And thank you all for listening. We will be back again in 2 weeks, and see you then.